Hello, and welcome to another episode of our podcast series, AGG Talks, Antitrust and White Collar Crime Roundup, in which we cover the legal facts surrounding recent cases, trends, and hot topics related to antitrust and white collar crime with some of our foremost legal analysis in the country. My name is Jeff Jakubowicz. I am a trial attorney with Arnell Golden Gregory. I am also an adjunct criminal antitrust law professor at American University Washington College of Law, and I chair the firm's antitrust group. I have appeared a number of times on CNN and MSNBC regarding various white-collar criminal investigations and political cases. That includes the Mueller investigation and the recent Donald Trump indictments. I'm joined today by frequent TV legal analyst Michael Zeldin. Michael has served as a federal prosecutor, a private sector lawyer, a law professor, and on a global consulting firm principal. Currently, he is the advisory neighborhood commissioner for the District of Columbia and host of the podcast That Said with Michael Zeldin. He is here with me today to cover several issues related to the ongoing litigation against former President Trump. Michael and I will discuss whether Trump will possibly take the stand in the New York upcoming criminal trial, if his former CFO will be eliminated as a witness because he just pled guilty, the Supreme Court's timing regarding absolute immunity decisions, and more. Michael, let's get started. Let me ask you about the New York DA criminal trial that's about to start. Do you think Donald Trump will take the stand in the Alvin Bragg trial?
Well, let me say first, Jeff, thank you for having me. It's an honor to be with you on your podcast today. In respect to the question, I think the answer is unlikely Trump will take the stand. He's got an interesting sort of defense theory here, which is he is not arguing reliance on the defense of counsel, because if he did, then they have a lot of discovery about the specific nature of his communications with his attorney. Instead, he's what we're calling reliance on defense of counsel light, meaning he's going to say there were a lot of lawyers in the room when this was being discussed, and because they were there, I was confident that everything that we were talking about was kosher, and therefore I had no criminal intent. I think he's going to try to make that case through other witnesses, either cross-examination of defense witnesses, prosecution witnesses, or some collateral defense witnesses. But I think him taking the stand to say essentially that the lawyers advised me will not work for him in this case. It's too dangerous for him. And I think if he tries to say that, the judge is going to say, well, you're really trying to backdoor a reliance on the defense of counsel. We're going to pause for additional discovery. So that's a long answer to what could be a short answer to say, nope, don't think he's going to take the stand.
Well, you know, if he opens the door and allows Michael Cohen to testify about any privileged communications, is that correct?
Well, Cohen is going to testify about what he did, what he saw. I don't know that he's necessarily going to talk about attorney-client privileged communications. That's still for Trump to waive or not waive. But you're absolutely right to say that if he goes this route of saying lawyers were there, does that de facto create a waiver where Trump and Cohen's communications can be brought to the jury? So I think that he is walking a very thin line here, but I don't know that you need to have the communications so much because the documents in the case set out a paper trail of how the monies were paid to Stormy Daniels through Michael Cohen, then back through the books and records of the organization. So Cohen just needs to really confirm the books and records evidence more than he needs to say, and this is what Donald Trump told me.
And Michael, would you say that the crime fraud exception may apply here as to any of those communications?
It could. It's a great question. I don't know whether it has been litigated yet. We know it was litigated in the Mar-a-Lago case, and the judge found that the crime fraud exception applies, meaning that because the communications involved crime and perpetuation of fraud, those attorney-client privileges fall by the wayside and the communications can come in. I just don't know, Jeff, whether or not they have been litigated that way in this case. But yes, arguably, if there is a motion to allow for the communications between them, the crime fraud exception would be the basis for that.
And what about the fact that Michael Cohen pled guilty to perjury? Alan Weisselberg, the CFO for Trump, pled guilty to perjury. How will that impact upon their testimony in this trial?
Well, as a defense attorney, you would argue they are not credible witnesses and they cannot be relied upon. And because they are perjurers, you have to discard everything they say. But of course, if they say something that can be corroborated by books and records documents, then yes, you can say this person isn't a saint, but in this case, he's telling the truth. And we saw that in the Mueller investigation with the Manafort trials and others where people had lied, then pleaded guilty to lying, but then came forward and testified truthfully about what occurred, supported by physical evidence.
And didn't we just see that with Judge Angeron in the Trump Organization trial where Michael Cohen testified and the judge credited his testimony despite the fact that he had pled guilty to perjury?
Exactly. Angeron said that, yes, this guy is not a perfect person, but we don't need perfect persons. We need witnesses who have the truth to tell that can be corroborated. I always think, Jeff, in these matters, corroboration of the testimony, whether it be by other live witnesses or by documentation, is the key to success. Just putting on Michael Cohen alone to tell his story with no additional corroboration, I think would be a non-starter for most prosecutors, given his history.
And what about Weisselberg? Weisselberg is probably a very risky witness for the prosecution.
Yeah, so Weisselberg is a really complicated witness. Yeah, he knows probably where all of the secrets are. That is, he was the controller, CFO of the Trump Organization. He is the one who Cohen says he worked with to orchestrate this scheme by which the Stormy Daniels would be hushed and her story quashed. The problem, though, is that Weisselberg has testified twice. He's found himself convicted for one of those cases, and then he pleaded guilty for perjury in the other of those cases. And so he is a very defective witness, but he also is the person who was the, according to David Pecker, the head of the National Enquirer, who was also part of this catch and kill scheme that Trump engaged in with Cohen and with others, he really should be the one who knows the intricacies of this. So I think if you and I were trying this case and we're trying to figure out, what do you do with Weisselberg? And Weisselberg says to us, you know what? I'm sick of shilling for Trump. I'm going to tell you the truth. I can walk you through all of these documents, transaction by transaction. I think we would put him on the stand and say, look, he's not perfect, but he knows the truth and he can be corroborated. So I think that's what the prosecutors will do. However, so far, Weisselberg has not agreed to be a cooperating witness. So if you put him on as a hostile witness, that's a whole different matter.
Well, Michael, you mentioned a catch and kill and David Pecker. Do you want to describe for our audience what catch and kill is?
Sure. As I understand it, someone has a story to tell. And you say to that person, I will pay you for your story. And you say, great, I will love to be paid for my story. You get paid for the story, and then you have the exclusive right per that contract to publish it. What they do, though, instead of publishing it, is they kill it. So essentially, they buy her silence, in this case, Stormy Daniels' silence. They paid her money for her story, which was this affair that she had with Donald Trump. And rather than publish it, as what you'd think a normal publication would do, they sat on it and they killed it. And so she got her payment, and the person who they were benefiting, Trump, got the story suppressed. It never saw the light of day before the election. That's the catch. Get her, kill, don't publish.
And weren't there other situations where there were catch and kill stories involving Donald Trump and David Pecker? And the reason I ask you that, Michael, is will that be admissible at trial?
There are allegations in the press for sure that they have done the same catch and kill over the course of their long relationship, Pecker and Trump's long relationship. Whether, if you're asking, does this come in as 404B, meaning pattern of behavior evidence. It's not clear to me, Jeff, because I don't know how the facts of those previous catch and kills compare to this one. If there's the same MO that can be established, that Pecker working with Cohen or working with Trump and Trump and Cohen did the same catch and kill, then I would think that it would meet the pattern behavior and be allowed to be introduced to say, look, this Stormy Daniels matter is not a one-off. This occurred in this previous case and this previous case, which buttresses the vitality of the allegation in the particular case on trial.
Michael, what about the fact that Trump's counsel in the New York case just filed a motion to delay the case because of the absolute immunity argument, which the Supreme Court hasn't yet ruled on and will soon entertain oral argument? Do you think that motion will be successful with Judge Merchan and delay the trial?
I don't think it will. I don't think it should. What the allegation here is that while this behavior occurred prior to the presidency, all this Stormy Daniels stuff occurred before Trump was elected president, and therefore there's no immunity. What Trump is trying to argue is that once he became president and he was communicating about this case to Cohen and others, that somehow bootstraps in presidential immunity because there were some communications which occurred during the term of his presidency. I don't think that holds much sway because, one, this is private conduct. It doesn't implicate at all his official conduct. Two, it occurred prior to his presidency. And to argue that a Twitter post or an appearance on Fox and Friends somehow is an official communication of the president that somehow will then create an immunity situation just seems to me too far-fetched. So I think, Jeff, the answer is it shouldn't prevail, and I think that it won't prevail.
Well, what about the fact, Michael, that some of the communications of the alleged cover-up occurred while Trump was president in terms of some of the payments and so forth? Do you think that would influence the judge?
I don't. I think that the fact that they happened to occur during a portion of his presidency but relate principally to private conduct prior to his presidency will not therefore transform this whole thing into official acts of the president that require an immunity decision before the case can go forward. I just think this is private conduct that will be heard in March as scheduled. And if you looked at the Bill Clinton versus Paula Jones case, you see similar patterns of the Supreme Court there finding that this is private conduct that preceded the presidency, and therefore the president is not, you know, sort of immune from prosecution during the term of his presidency. I think that's, by analogy, that sort of logic applies here.
And the Paula Jones case was a civil case, isn't that right?
It was a civil case, yeah. But the analysis that I'm trying to draw by analogy is that in that case, they talk about what is public, what is private conduct. And I think that type of analysis would apply here, that this we're talking in this case in New York, private conduct, not conduct that was part of the official duties of the President of the United States.
Michael, let's shift to one of the other criminal litigations, the one in Georgia. And in state court, Fonnie Willis and Nathan Wade just testified. There was a lengthy hearing. The issue is whether there's a conflict, whether Fonnie Willis benefited personally or financially as a result of appointing Nathan Wade. And what do you think Judge McAfee is going to do in that case?
So a couple of things. First, of course, as we broadcast this morning, we should know that McAfee in that case has dismissed 6 counts in that indictment, alleging that they did not specify criminal conduct with enough clarity for the defendants to respond. So you've got 6 counts that have been thrown out. The judge did not say that they are permanently thrown out. The prosecutors probably could go back to a grand jury and get the specificity the judge is asking for. But since 6 counts are gone, now we're waiting for the decision that you've just asked about, which is, will the prosecutor and the special prosecutor, Wade, be thrown off of the case. And I think that the answer to that question depends on the analysis that the judge brings to it. That is, if he's going to ask the narrow question, did the prosecutor benefit financially from this case in a way that was improper, then I don't think the evidence is sufficient to sustain a dismissal of them on that basis. If he's going to say, does the appearance of conflict state a sufficient basis for me to remove them, then I think it's a much closer case. Because when they started having their relationship, assuming it occurred after Wade was hired, Wade should have stepped aside immediately. Or Fannie Willis should have notified somebody about this to keep it sort of Sabrosa under the table for all this time to have it come out this way. It was McAfee, who worked for Fannie Willis, worked in that office, might just say, you know what, this case is too important to have this cloud hanging over it with these allegations, and so I'm going to ask you to step aside. That's a possibility. The thing that matters to me most and should matter to the prosecution and the integrity of the prosecution most is whether he recuses the entire office. If he recuses Fannie Willis individually, Nathan Wade individually, there's really no harm to the case. The deputy district attorney can step in Fannie Willis's place. She's nearly not part of the trial team. She's just sort of an observer at the moment. And Nathan Wade is another prosecutor who can take his place. Maybe it slows it down a little bit, but the case proceeds. If he disqualifies the entire office, then they got to go find a new district attorney's office. There's a commission that looks into that. It'll take forever to do that. It could go after the election. Then there could be a new district attorney who views the evidence and decides that they don't want to bring this case. Remember, we saw this, Jeff, in New York. Cyrus Vance was proceeding with the New York criminal case, and then he decides not to run for re-election. Bragg gets elected instead and looks at the evidence differently. So all of that stuff, if their office comes out of this case, is going to be a huge problem for this case going forward, reasonably or perhaps even at all.
And McAfee has the authority to ask Fannie Willis or Nathan Wade to resign or dismiss them from the case and keep the case in Fulton County?
I think so. I don't know that for sure. Because she is the district attorney, if he removes her, does that automatically mean that the whole office is removed, or can he distinguish the office from the individual and say, you can't be part of this anymore, but the office through your deputies or whomever can proceed with the case? It's a great question. I don't know the nuanced answer to it, but I would think it makes sense to me that an individual U.S. attorney in a U.S. attorney's office or an individual district attorney in a district attorney's office could individually step aside and the office still be allowed to prosecute the case. But that remains to be seen.
Sure. There's probably a lot of uncertainty here, because it's very rare that this occurs. I mean, in all your years at Department of Justice, did you ever see this happen?
Well, you've seen cases that get removed from one jurisdiction to another. In the Oklahoma City bombing case, for example, they removed the trial from Oklahoma to Denver, but the prosecutors stayed on the case. They just had to try it with a different jury pool. You've seen cases where U.S. attorneys have recused themselves from the case because they worked on a matter related to it, and they felt that for the matters of appearance, they would step aside. But I haven't seen a case where a judge recused, if you will, the entire office for the acts of one. They may exist, but none come to mind.
Well, Michael, we are out of time, and we never got to the January 6th indictment nor the Mar-a-Lago indictment.
So you know what that means. We have to have part two sometime in the future.
And it's not clear when those cases will go to trial, particularly the Florida case. And it appears certainly it won't go to trial before the election. And it looks like the Georgia case won't go to trial before the election. But the one that will, apparently, definitely, will be the New York one. I want to thank you for appearing today. I hope the listeners found this discussion to be informative. If you have any questions or would like to submit your feedback or topics for future podcasts, please feel free to reach out to me, Jeff Jacobowitz, and you could find my contact information on AGG.com. This episode will be distributed through our AGG website and social media pages. Thank you once again, Michael, for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Jeff.